And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Whitney Terrell to the program today. He's written three novels, The Huntsman, The King of Kings County, and today we'll be talking about his most recent, The Good Lieutenant, a novel about a horrible incident in war-torn Iraq, which is told in reverse chronology. Now, Whitney, you yourself covered the war in Iraq, at least on a couple of different trips, but when did the character of Lieutenant Emma Fowler come to you?
You know, I have tried to retrace that. I mean, specifically, Emma was there from the beginning. There's a scene that's late in the book where I have a flashback about her and her mother. And that scene was written before I ever went to Iraq. And so, obviously, that character existed before I ever embedded. As to why, you know, that's a little bit more complicated, like why I chose to write about a female soldier or why that particular person. And I think for me, the best answer is that I always try to find somebody who's outside of a structure or bureaucratic institution that I'm going to try to write about. And it's a little hard to find that in a volunteer army. I mean, in the past, a lot of times you'd have somebody who's drafted, like Yossarian, who doesn't want to be there or something like that. And so I'd been doing a lot of reading about the war, and I realized that it was a unique situation, probably the first time in our history when this many women were going to be involved in a war. And so I started to think about that as a possibility.
You, like the soldiers and Marines who were sent over there, were a volunteer. Why did you decide to go over and cover the war?
Well, I mean, first of all, I am no war correspondent, nor a particularly brave person. You know, there are many war correspondents who spent much more time than I did in Iraq. I don't want to overemphasize my, like, I'm a really tough war reporter guy. But I did feel like it was going to be important. A novelist can get almost everything. You can research and learn a lot of stuff on their own. But in this particular case, I just realized that if I wasn't actually on the ground looking at stuff and talking to people, it wasn't going to be possible for me to write a novel about the war in Iraq. And I'm really, in retrospect, glad that I went. Although, when this book wasn't going well, and I didn't think it was going to work, and it had been a bad gamble, I spent a lot of time being very angry with myself because it seemed like an unnecessary risk. I mean, soldiers are taking a necessary risk. That is part of their job. They have to go. Doesn't mean that it's any less nerve-wracking or worrisome, right? But for me, it was a totally voluntary risk. And to me, that felt a little bit stupider at certain times, right?
Well, so how did your family feel about this decision?
Well, it was interesting. My wife was always totally fine with it. So I don't know what that says about it. She's like, you'll be okay.
You have a good relationship with an insurance person or something?
That's an interesting question. You cannot get life insurance when you're going over there. I didn't have insurance. There's no net. But she just thought it was going to work out. Now, it might have been because I didn't emphasize that I was going to be spending time outside of the wire, and I think she was a little bit more dismayed at the amount of time that I did spend outside of the wire when I got back, when she found out about it. But she was fine with it. My mother, who has watched me do ridiculous things my entire life, was, of course, frightened the entire time, and she was not in favor of it. But that's how that usually is between her and I. My son was, the first time I went, a year old, so he didn't have an opinion. But he was the one that you think about, and at least it gives you some insight. You have just private thoughts, right? What if I don't see my son again? You know, I mean, a journalist had been killed in the area where I was going to embed in 2006, right before I went there, killed by a roadside bomb. If you go on a patrol outside of the wire, you're just as vulnerable as anybody else. There's no special journalist car that you get to go in. Now, again, my like percentage risks were very low compared to a real soldier, right? But if I got that nervous thinking about, oh, God, what an idiot I would feel like if my son grew up without a father because of this trip. Imagine what it's like for a soldier who's facing a 12-month deployment, you know, who has, especially at that time in 2006, when a lot of people were dying over there. The mental stress of that is difficult to imagine, but it helped me imagine it.
The good lieutenant is Emma Fowler, but there's also another fairly fresh lieutenant in there, Pulaski.
Yeah.
Dixon Pulaski. And
the goof-off lieutenant.
So the question is, these people know they're going into a war situation, and presumably post 9/11, so they know they're going into war if they join the military.
You know, if this is set...
Is it 2005 or so?
Yeah, 2005, 2006. I think you'd have to go back and look at exactly, you know, in other words, I think their timeline, if you work it out, would have been that they were joining ROTC at a time at which they weren't aware that we were going to necessarily be going into war. And I think that there were a lot of officers in Iraq who had sort of signed up and then it happened, right? Because there's a long delay time. Mm-hmm. You got to do 4 years of college, right? And I think that was important, and particularly in Pulaski's case, right? This was not what he wanted to do at all, you know? There's a passage where he talks about figuring that the war would be over, right, by the time he actually got to be in charge of anything or to be an active duty personnel. And he was wrong about that. So I think when you're signing up in RTC, actually, now that I'm thinking about the actual timeline of the book, I think the way Pulaski talks about it, I'd have to sit here with my, I have a timeline at home, but I think he would have signed up, you know, what is it, 2006, 4 years of college, a couple years of training. So it probably could have been around, would have been around 2000, 2001. That would be my guess. And so if he had signed up even after 9/11, he could easily imagine, I'm not going to see any of this. Because, when we're talking about signing up, we're talking about starting college as a freshman and taking the ROTC money to help pay for it. That was the big reason that he joins ROTC.
But it seems like with his orientation toward authority, it wasn't a good fit even if we'd been in peacetime.
Well, yes, he does not like authority. He's not at all an army, your average army type person. But he's joining because he's angry with his father, who has divorced his mom sort of late in his high school career, in Pulaski's high school years. And he doesn't want to take any money from his father. He doesn't want to be a burden to his mother. He does have a military history in his family because his father was in the military, was a doctor. And so he chooses this, right, as a way to assert his independence from his father. And that makes perfect sense to me. You do something because you're mad at a family member or have a rivalry with your dad, but that something isn't exactly the thing that you would have chosen if you weren't thinking about this other issue.
And also he's a member of the Signal Corps, so you don't exactly think of that as a combat position.
You know, Camp Liberty, where I stayed when I was embedded in 2006, you know, there's like 40,000 people there. And there are a tremendous number, and this is neither bad nor good. This is just a fact. There's a lot of people who are in the military, go to Iraq, work inside the wire on a very large base in an air-conditioned office building doing paperwork. Now, a Signal Corps guy isn't necessarily that type, but, you know, Pulaski has reason to think that his tour is not going to be as dangerous as an infantry soldier, for instance.
And he thinks anyone that does anything other than the bare minimum required of their position is an idiot.
Yes, he does. Are there not people like this?
Well, I think that's our world.
He's like my, he's the Army version of a guy from a Dilbert cartoon. He's sarcastic. He is part of a large organization. He is content to just be a cog in it. He doesn't want to be a hero. You know, the best thing about the organization in it for him is Emma, whom he meets and falls in love with.
Now, Emma is the lieutenant of a recovery platoon over in Iraq, and it's not a combat position, but, you know, they take fire a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what she would have been technically is in charge of a maintenance platoon, and within that they'd have a recovery unit. This recovery unit, their job is to go out and retrieve vehicles that are hit by IEDs or disabled or that roll into a canal or throw a tire or, you know, the transmission breaks down on a tank and somebody got to get it back to camp somehow. And so they have these vehicles. One is called a Hercules, or also known as an M88, which is a huge sort of tank-like vehicle with, instead of, you know, a big gun in front, it has a huge boom and winch. And I've been in those vehicles and climbed all over them and ridden in them. They're really amazing, and they're the only thing that can tow an M1 tank. So she's in charge of these vehicles, and it is dangerous. If you go out and a vehicle is abandoned or dumped in a canal and your job is to get it back, you know, if there are enemy forces in the area, you're a good target, you know. And also, if you're towing stuff on roads, you're slower. You can get hit with an IED just as well as anyone else.
And all they care about is seeing an American get hit. They don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't.
What.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody thinks, oh, that's a support team. We're not going to mess with them.
Now, The Good Lieutenant isn't a military thriller. It's a story of flawed people whose personal and professional relationships have very serious consequences. And you've done an untraditional storytelling technique of going into a reverse chronology. Why did you pick that way to tell the story?
That would not have been my first choice. I'm a realist writer, so I'm interested in realism. But one of the things that I did grow up studying and caring about were modernist writers like William Faulkner, you know. And Faulkner uses time in a brilliant intelligent ways. He's a realist, but he can shift time. And it's one of the things that books can do that movies can't do. So anyway, I was at a position where I didn't feel like the book was working, and I felt like the end of the book was far too grim. And my editor wanted me to get to the end, the last 100 pages, more quickly, and I kept trying to write a new beginning, and it also felt quite boring. And one day, at a loss, I was shuffling some papers on my desk and mistakenly put an earlier scene behind another scene, right? Now, I'd asked myself the question, you know, why isn't this working? And the answer had been, the ending is too dark and too narrow. So I was ready to find an answer. And when I paged through and saw a scene from earlier in the book after the ending, this flash of, you know, whatever, inspiration is a real thing. And I realized, oh, if I go backward, then I don't have to worry about how negative the ending is, because the characters will grow, get more complicated and more human the farther that they get away from the conflict that they're in and this terrible situation, which is now the opening scene of the book. And the book will be about how they got there and what changed in them, the process of being at war, and how it changed them, caused them to make the decisions that lead to what is the opening scene of the book. So I think a lot of people read the opening scene and they're like, you know, oh my God, well, what are they doing? The telling of the novel is to answer those questions.
In traditionally linear narratives, we have a dramatic tension that builds.
Right.
But in this way, it's more of a dread, because we know the results and then we see what goes up to it, and we can't stop them from doing the things that lead to these terrible happenings.
Well, don't many of us feel that way about Iraq? You know, we're looking at ISIS having taken over many of the areas that I was in when I was there as a reporter. And we look back on that war, right? And think, what could we have done differently? Where were the places that we were? We don't want this. What's happening right now in Iraq is the last thing that we wanted to have happen. And I think that working backward in our minds is something that America is doing right now with this war, trying to figure out, how could we have done this right? Should we have done it at all? And so the book approximates that kind of questioning. But in terms of a simple reading experience, it's like a mystery story in reverse. Rather than wanting to find out what happened, you're trying to find out how it happened, you know?
But it's different from an in media res experience, where you go back then to a beginning to come back.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Like, a lot of times people will show the end of a story and then start at the beginning. This is straight. Every single chapter is set in an earlier time than the one before it. The other thing that's interesting about a lot of war novels, and they're good. I am a tremendous reader and studier, and I care a lot about very good war novels. You know, I think James Jones is a terrific writer and have read his work and learned a lot from it, you know, here, just to name one person of many, many, many. But there's an established chronology to the war novel, which is sort of training, deployment, combat, and then denouement. And one of the charges when you're writing literary fiction comes from Ezra Pound, you know, make it new. And even though I thought up this structure due to a sort of crisis that I was telling you about, you know, what I realized also was that it was new, and it allowed me to think about the way war novels are structured in a different way. In other words, maybe combat shouldn't be in the climax part of the book. And maybe by the fact that combat is always in the climax part of the book, maybe that tells us something narratively about combat that isn't always true, right? In other words, if combat is where the decisions and the characters' true selves are revealed, it becomes this, like, something that you almost want to do, you know? Like, so I can find out my true self, I'll go into battle. And I think that that is a summary of something that young men think a lot. I certainly did when I was a kid. And that's not, in my view and in my experience, a good way to figure out what your character is.
But in this, it's not just like a backwards telling where we're hitting rewind on a scene. It's actually, you have to go to a point in the past and then move forward from that point.
Yeah.
So how do you decide which point to move forward back to? Backwards to, in order
I get
to
that. Forward. That's interesting. I mean, since I wrote the book forward the first time, and then what I did when I discovered that I was going to tell the story backward is I just laid each chapter out in a reverse order on my office floor, right? So, I mean, chapters are established in the same way that you in this book that they would in any other book. Like, in other words, you want to begin at some point where a character has a decision to make, and there's going to be an arc within the chapter of change, right? And you want to end at a place that's suspenseful or interesting. So in that sense, the chapters are chosen like chapters would be in any other book. What you have to do is give the reader enough information about what's going on in this scene that they don't feel totally lost. And then they have to trust you that you're going to make specific references to something like, oh, that time Beale rushed into the building. Beale is the platoon sergeant for Fowler's platoon and was kidnapped. They talk about it. You're like, I don't know about Beale rushing into the building and getting kidnapped. What happened there?
And you hear about the specter of the Muthanna intersection explosions.
Yeah, you hear about a truck bombing. You're like, I haven't seen the truck bombing. And so you have to establish a bond of trust with the reader that I know you don't. I'll tell you about it. Trust me, it's coming, right? And if you can establish that by satisfying some of those smaller questions, even in the next immediate chapter, right, then the reader starts to understand how the book's going to work and will hopefully come with you on that journey.
Most of the people we meet aren't all hoorah and wanting to go out and engage the enemy. Fowler isn't doing enough PT. I mean, she's getting out of shape. She's very messy in her personal quarters. Pulaski doesn't want to go outside of the wire and be there what the mission's for. Beale is supposed to be the platoon sergeant, supposed to be kind of experienced and have this knowledge and be a force of stability in the platoon, but he's kind of a goofball.
Right.
And so we have all these people who probably aren't best suited for their jobs.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, to me, they're human beings, and the army is made up of human beings who are imperfect, right? And so these kinds of personal characteristics and things that people make mistakes on and goof up on and don't do right, that's part of life in the army too, you know?
All organizations are dysfunctional because they're made up of humans.
Well, yes. And so I think that it would, first of all, not be a very interesting book if I made everybody perfect. And it wouldn't be accurate. And I think it's okay to create conflict among individuals and to talk about people's shortcomings, whether you're talking about an office environment or the Army. You know, to me, that was one of the great reassuring things about the Army, actually, that they were people. All soldiers are people. They bring their past with them to work. And because they're working under such stressful circumstances, any flaws that they have are going to be magnified, and they have to find ways to overcome them, to learn to work together. Part of the arc of the book is Emma Fowler learning how to be a good lieutenant. She's not a particularly good one when she first starts out as a young lieutenant in Fort Riley. She's too rule-oriented. She's not interested in forming personal bonds with her soldiers. She wants to just tell them what to do and have them do it. And you can't be a good leader that way. And so, you know, one of the important things that happens in the book is her learning how to negotiate her relationship with Sergeant Beale.
And Pulaski.
And Pulaski's very helpful.
Right. And for a guy who wants to be a gold brick, he seems to be giving out a lot of advice.
Well, he's an outsider, you know, also an outsider to male culture, male bonding culture, locker room culture, right? Which I'm not an outsider to, you know. But Pulaski, any outsider is also an observer, right? And so one of the things, I spent a lot of time interviewing female soldiers in Iraq. One of the very first women that I interviewed, a captain named Jen McDonough, she was a captain at the time, has the job that Emma Fowler has in the book. I interviewed her in Iraq in 2006. One of the things that they said to me was, look, you're in charge of a platoon of guys, right? You got to learn how to talk to them the way that they talk. And now, look, some women are just as good at flipping blank than as guys are, right? But sometimes you haven't had a lot of practice in that in your high school, eighth grade, sixth grade life, right? So you got to learn how to do it. And Fowler, that's one of the things that she has to sort of consciously figure out. Okay, how do I talk to these guys to get them to listen to me? And it's not just giving orders. You got to be funny. You got to be able to make fun of yourself. There's a lot of things that she has to learn how to do. And Pulaski is a good observer and helps her, coaches her in some ways on that.
One of these things that we hear about and that we have to kind of find the genesis of later in the book is an infantry officer named Masterson who takes these shackles from her platoon. Were these bits of hardware or restraints?
No. Shackle is like used to clip down vehicles as they're put on rail cars to go to the port to be sent overseas. And so I did spend a lot of time out at Fort Riley looking at the place where they staged the vehicles and figuring out how they got all their gear from Fort Riley to Kuwait and ultimately Iraq. And so, yeah, the shackles were really important because it's not that they're so valuable, it's that there weren't enough. And you're issued a certain number. And if you don't have enough to clip all your vehicles down onto the rail car, you are screwed. And so this was a thing that people would fight over. It's a scarcity issue. And I interviewed a woman named Major Stacy Moore, who is the XO to the commanding general at Fort Riley. And she told me that story when I met her and talked to her. And so I wrote it into the book.
Now, I haven't read as many military novels as you, but that problem with requisitioning stuff illegally.
Yeah.
Reminded me a little bit of Robert O'Connor's Buffalo Soldiers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a great book. That's a great book. Look, it happens all the time, you know? And for me, getting inside Army culture and thinking about, look, anything in any organization, the things that you do that you're not supposed to do and why you have to do the things that you're not supposed to do, that's the most revealing thing, right? So I always look for those.
Now, the second relationship that we look at most in depth in the story is that of an Iraqi man named Ayad and his childhood friend Faisal.
Yeah. It was very important to me to write from the point of view of Iraqis in this book. That was also an idea that I had from the very beginning. Higher degree of difficulty than perhaps if I'd been thinking rationally, you know, I would have chosen. But the Iraqis are an incredibly important part of this conflict. They're not strange, odd others, you know, and in fact, American soldiers formed intense bonds and friendships with Iraqis while they were there. In many ways, our soldiers were trying to help the large majority of Iraqis and thought and conceived of their mission in that way. We want to help these people create a peaceful civil society. And many Iraqis were involved in that effort. Many Iraqis opposed that effort. And so I wanted to have that point of view register and to be able to narrate from the point of view of these characters rather than just view them off in a distance as a sort of symbol of this country, but we don't really know them. We don't know anything about them. To that end, I mean, first of all, I watched and talked to the interpreters who were working with the battalion that I was embedded with in 2006. But I also met an Iraqi named Khaldun Ahmad, who was living at the time that I met him a couple blocks from my house in Kansas City. And it turns out this was after I had been to Iraq the first time in 2006. It turns out he was from the exact area that my battalion had been patrolling. And he had been living in Iraq at the time that I was embedded there and had left when a roadside bomb had gone off very close to him and almost killed him, and he decided it was time for him to get out. He was a geophysicist, and he was studying at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I started talking to him a lot about life there, showing him passages, asking him what kind of food do people eat? Is this what's the decor of this house? What would it be like? All that stuff. And that became a really fascinating part of the book for me, like hearing the war from his perspective.
Ayad is an outsider in his culture because he's deaf and his parents had money, so they have a little land, and he's educated, unlike the other people nearby.
He is a very good character. I mean, in other words, he has probably the purest motives of any character in the book. He just wants to stay alive. And he also wants to protect his friend, Faisal. Those are good motives. But creating perfectly good characters isn't really all that interesting. So to connect him to the Ba'ath Party, to have his family have been wealthy and have benefited from Saddam's rule, was a way of talking about that part of Iraq and Iraq's history as well. You know, Saddam was a terrible leader. And the people who benefited from his rule were great, but left a lot of people out. And, you're seeing evidence of that in the civil war that started in 2006 and is continuing to go on now.
His family didn't like Faisal, and they were probably right.
It's a Sunni-Shia thing, right? Ayad is a Sunni, and Faisal's a Shia. And so the Sunnis, who were the ruling party in Saddam Hussein's time, treat the Shia as like second-class citizens. Yeah, you're right. Faisal's not trustworthy, but is that because everyone assumes he's not trustworthy, and so that's the role that he's forced to inhabit? You know, if he had been a Sunni, would he have been the way that he is? I think those are interesting questions. You know, like, to what extent do the way people perceive us change the way that we are?
And the Sunnis were allied with the Ba'ath Party, right?
Saddam was a Sunni, and so, you know, they had been the ruling party in Iraq for a very long period of time.
So it's been quite a long time since your second novel.
Yes.
The Kings of King County.
Tell me about it.
So was it just the structure that was giving you difficulty in finishing this book, or?
No, I think that, you know, look, if you're a guy who's written two novels that are set in Kansas City and deal with the issues of race, I'm writing about a city that I know extremely well. My family's been living there for a very long time, and I'm working out of a well-known tradition. Suddenly, you want to write a novel about a war that's taking place in the Middle East, which you don't know anything about, and you don't really know that much about the army. There's a long, long learning curve, and it is not surprising in retrospect that it took me a long time to get to where I could write the book well. I mean, aside from the fact that you got to take two overseas trips and report and write the nonfiction that comes with that and talk to a lot of soldiers and do a ton of interviewing. Also, there was no template for me for how to write about the war in Iraq. And the experience of it, first seeing it, is so extraordinary that, you know, that it's like an overload, you know, of your circuitry. And my first attempts to write the book were very much kind of like somebody playing a guitar on 11, you know? I mean, too loud, too jangly, too much. And that's what it felt like, you know? But it took a long time to learn how to modulate that and tell a story that didn't feel like it was all at the same extremely loud volume.
Did you ever wander away and try to start something else?
Yeah, I totally did. There was a point at which I'd finished the draft of the book in order in 2011. My original editor for my first two novels had died in the process while I was working on this book, and my publisher of my first two novels wasn't interested in that draft. And I, you know, freaked out, decided it was terrible, tried to rewrite it for a year, couldn't. There's nothing more frustrating than spending a year on something and making zero progress. Put it aside, thought about changing careers, you know. I was not a professor at that time. In other words, I'm on a tenure track now. I was a writer in residence, but that is the same as being an adjunct, really. So I was very nervous about losing my job because as writer in residence, because I'd published a couple books, I was paid a lot more than an adjunct was, right? But it was after 2008 by now, financial crisis. I thought, you know, if I was going to fire somebody at this university, I think I'd fire Terrell. Let's fire him. He gets paid too much. He doesn't do enough. He's not tenured. We don't, you know.
It sounds like you had some of those doubts. Fowler was, you really had some
insider.
I totally
had those doubts. A lot of the things that, you know, you have to find a part of you that chimes with any particular character. And Emma's worried about whether or not she's going to be able to make it as a lieutenant. And those were certainly things that I was worrying about in terms of whether I was going to be able to make it as a writer. So those are reasons why. I took a year off. I thought about doing another job. And then finally, around 2012 or 13, I asked my agent to send the book out to everybody. We had only sent it to one place, right? I hadn't made any changes. It's been 2 years, right? So it must have been 2013. My current editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux said, hey, this is interesting. Let's talk about how to make this work. And that little window of hope, you know, somebody saying, hey, I think this can work, was all I needed. You know, but I had worked on this book also the whole time without really any editorial advice, without an editor to work with. And by then, I think that I had thought about it enough that I was ready to write the book the right way. It just took that long.
So it was almost like Fowler in the way that there was a situation that occurred in the book in which she just felt terrible afterwards, but someone then pointed out all the things she did right in the moment and that she completely discounted that.
Yes.
And so you had those doubts.
Yeah, of course. I think that anyone... Can't we all relate to being overly self-critical?
Well, I'm wonderful. I don't know about you.
You know, to me, that's one of the attractive and lovely things about Emma Fowler. And one of the things that I relate to about her is that she can take a situation where she's done a bunch of things right or even death-defying and then think about the one thing that she messed up. I think that's how people get better. I think also think that people can wear themselves out being that way. There's two sides to that coin. But it doesn't matter whether it's a good or bad behavior. It is her character. She will always do that, and she has to live with it.
So with 10 years on this novel.
Yay!
What are you working on now?
I have started a new book that I'm very excited about, but I'm not far enough in to say what it's going to be about. But it is started, and as soon as I am done with the lucky privilege of getting to go around and talk about this book, I'm going to go home and be writing on it full time.
You come from Kansas City, which, like Memphis, is one of the more dangerous cities in America. Do you think that was any bit of preparation for going over to Iraq?
That's interesting. I don't know that I would draw that comparison, but I would say that what was surprising to me about the area of operations in 2006, where we were, 2010 was a little more complicated. I was at Balad, which is a big base in central Iraq, and drove up toward Mosul. But west of Baghdad looks a lot like the area of western and central Kansas where Fort Riley is. It looked very familiar to me. I mean, if you replace the cottonwood trees with the eucalyptus trees and, you know, the sort of hedgerows that are used to divide the fields with, you know, date palms, you'd be pretty close. And so that was interesting to me, just landscape-wise, how comfortable I felt in that area and how it didn't feel exotic.
But you didn't have to worry about those plains winters.
Yeah. I was luckily not embedded in Iraq in the wintertime, but it can get cold there, too, and rains a lot, I'm told.
But the coldest I've ever been in my life is Kansas City.
Kansas
City? 15 below.
Well, then you haven't been to Iowa.
No, I've been to Iowa just in the summertime. I'm not all dumb. Well, Whitney, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing the good lieutenant with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I forgot. I mean, is there any echoing to Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier?
I am certainly aware of and have read and studied The Good Soldier when I mean, many years ago, starting in high school, I think it was assigned to me by Ed Quigley, who was my very first English professor. And I think that's a great book, but I wasn't thinking about it in any way. The reason I called the book The Good Lieutenant was that I had this idea that stayed constant throughout the entire time of writing the book, which is I wanted the book to be about good people, a good person, someone like Emma, who you felt like started the book with a moral framework that you could agree with and understand as a reader, and show how that good person making what good decisions that you would agree with and understand could end up in a place and doing a thing that if I told you that without telling you the backstory, you'd say, well, I would never do that, right? And so this book is about asking the reader to go on that journey of change with Emma, talking about how war in a complicated, difficult, and sometimes contradictory place like Iraq can change your life.
Whitney Terrell is the author of The Good Lieutenant, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.